1 Peter 1:22 through 2:12, the fourth talk in a series on 1 Peter, was presented by Peter Wieringa on May 18, 2008, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2008. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
This morning, we're going to be looking at 1 Peter chapter 1, starting with verse 22. We're going to look at the last couple of verses of chapter 1, and then the first 12 verses of chapter 2. That's the passage that we'll be looking at. But before we jump into the passage, let me start off with a little bit of an introduction here. One of the things that I have noticed about this community, about this group of people, one of the things that I find so refreshing about this community is that there is such a realistic view of human nature and of mankind. Often in the church, there is sort of a rosy picture of who we're supposed to be as people. In this community, there's a much more realistic, down-to-earth picture. There's sort of an ongoing joke. If you are a Gutenberg student, and if you're thinking about getting married by one of the tutors, don't expect the normal wedding ceremony. You won't have a wedding talk that is all sweetness and light with doves and cherubs flying around, that sort of thing. That's not what you're going to get from the Gutenberg tutors, who are the gentlemen that teach here most of the time. You're going to get a down-to-earth, all the warts included, view of what it means to be married, with all of the ups and downs and all of the and an accurate portrayal of what it's like when two people who are themselves deeply flawed come together in that intimate and personal relationship. That's what Logan and Leanne have to look forward to. And as Bob said, we won't talk about Logan anymore. But when you are with this group of people, you get that sort of real, realistic understanding of human nature. Now, there's an upside to that, there's a downside to that, and that's part of what we're going to be talking about as we work through this passage in 1 Peter. The upside of that is that we come to understand that we as believers struggle with our sinfulness just like everyone else does. There's a real relief, there's a real sense of freedom in understanding that we're not expected to be perfect. Again, very often in the Christian community, there's this expectation that when we walk through the doors of the church, we're supposed to paste on a smile and act as though everything is going just fine, when we know that just minutes before we were yelling at our spouse or at our children or something like that. But in the church, all too often, we think that we need to pretend that everything's okay, and we can't let anyone else see our weaknesses as though we don't have those weaknesses. Well, the upside of the perspective around here is a recognition that, yes, there are struggles in the Christian life. Yes, I am deeply flawed. I am deeply sinful. And we need to recognize that, and we need to deal with that reality. The good side of that is there's some relief in recognizing that. But there's also, in my mind, there's also a downside to that. I've talked with some folks who become so weighed down, if you will, so burdened by this understanding of their own sinfulness that they're almost incapacitated. They almost become hopeless, feeling as though if I'm really that bad, well, what's the point? I can't do anything right anyway. I can't not sin anyway. So what's the point? So there's these two extremes that I think we run into in the church. And I think that the passage that we're looking at this morning, that I'll be getting into in a couple minutes here in 1 Peter, helps to give us a perspective that helps us to understand that there's a balance between falling down too far in either of those directions, going to extremes in either of those two directions. What we're told in many places, in the Old Testament and in the New Testament, countless places, we are told exactly how it is we're supposed to behave. And I can't believe that we would have, and I'll be talking more about this in a little bit, but I can't believe we'd have all those discussions of how we're supposed to behave, what we're supposed to do, if there is no hope of our lives ever conforming to that, if there's no hope of our behaviors ever being changed. The Old Testament, the New Testament, both in many places tell us, do this, don't do that. And so we've got to figure out, okay, how do we think about that? How are we supposed to deal with those passages, deal with those discussions? Well, let me go off on a little bit of a tangent here, and as we're looking at the passage, I hope you'll see how I got off on this tangent. But what I'm going to suggest to us here this morning is that this passage, and I think other passages in the New Testament, equate the believing community of today, or we'll speak more specifically of New Testament times, equate the believing community of New Testament times with Israel in the Old Testament. And the reason I say that, or the reason that that's important for our discussion this morning, for the passage that we're looking at, is because in the Old Testament, God set aside the nation of Israel to be a picture, I would suggest, a symbolic picture of a people whose lives were intended to be different from those of the people around them. As you've heard often from the podium up here, as different people have taught, God gave to the Jews in the Old Testament a whole bunch of silly activities, a whole bunch of odd things for them to do, odd behaviors that characterized their lives, characterized their ceremonial practices, and part of that was to set them apart from, make them distinct from all the nations around them. And if you read through the Old Testament, the distinctions between the Jews, the nation of Israel, and the other nations around them were huge. The behaviors, the morality, the worship practices, the differences were absolutely enormous between the Jews and everyone else around them. And what I'm going to suggest this morning is that we as believers, or the believers to whom Peter is writing in 1 Peter, that those believers, likewise, it was intended by God that their lives be different, that their behaviors be different. One of the things that I think is almost funny, it's interesting, almost funny about the way the New Testament writers talk about believers. Peter does this a couple of times in his letter here. They talk about believers in terms of being exiles, in terms of being strangers, in terms of being aliens. The point being that I think the New Testament writers recognize that the believing community likewise does not fit in with their culture. The believing community does not conform to the morality and the behaviors of the world around it. And that's part of what I think Peter is going to be talking about here in this passage today. So we see that I'm going to suggest that what the Old Testament pictured as an image of what God had in mind for his people, that they be different, that they be distinct, that picture is actually realized, is actually lived out, I would suggest, in the lives of those who have faith, not just in New Testament times and beyond, but I would suggest that in actuality, and we're not going to get into this in detail this morning, that isn't part of our passage, but I would suggest that in actuality, from the very beginning, going all the way back to the garden, God had always intended that there be a people whose lives are characterized by faith, whose lives were in fact different from those of the culture around them. The Jews were intended to picture that and did in many respects, but they failed in many respects. It seems to me as though when you look at the Old Testament admonitions to the nation of Israel, what God usually says to them is he says something along the lines of, I will be your God if you obey me and keep my commandments. And as we all know, they failed to do that with great consistency. The nation of Israel, the Jews left on their own, were simply unable to live up to those expectations. They were simply unable to change their behaviors, to change their lives in such a way that they truly sought to obey God and to follow God. But what was pictured by the Jews in the Old Testament, I think, has been realized throughout human history in the Old Testament and the New Testament by those who have faith, by those who follow God. That's what I think Paul is talking about when he wrote Hebrews. In Hebrews chapter 11, for example, I think that's what he's talking about there. Well, now let's start to zero in a little bit more on this passage, the passage we're going to look at this morning. Peter wrote this letter to the churches of Asia Minor, all the way back in chapter 1, verse 1, to those who reside as aliens, he says, scattered throughout Pontus, Galatia, Cappadocia, Asia, Bithynia. He wrote this letter to the churches that were in those areas, and I would suggest that those churches were primarily Gentile churches. There might very well have been Jews there, but the sense of this letter seems to be that he was writing primarily to Gentiles who had come to belief and who were a part of the church at that point. And as he writes to them, it's unavoidable as you go through 1 Peter, you simply can't avoid the number of times that he talks about their behavior, the number of times he talks about the way they're to live their lives. As I went through it in preparation, I came up with about 16, 17, and the number isn't important, but a large number of different places that Peter came back to discussing how they're to behave. In chapter 1, verses 14 through 16, he tells them, as obedient children, do not be conformed to the former lusts which were yours in your ignorance. And I'm just pulling a few out of the book here in 1 Peter 2, verse 1. Therefore, putting aside all malice and all guile and hypocrisy and envy and all slander. In 2, verses 18 through 20, he tells servants to be submissive to their masters. In 1 Peter 3, verses 8 through 9, he says, to sum up, let all be harmonious, sympathetic, brotherly, kind-hearted, humble in spirit. You get the picture. Throughout the book of 1 Peter, he talks again and again about how they're to behave, how they're to live their lives. And in fact, when there's a specific word that is translated behavior that he throws in here five times. The reason I make this point is because I want us to recognize that in spite of a recognition of our sinfulness, in spite of a recognition of how deeply flawed we are, that doesn't mean that there isn't the communicated expectation in the Old Testament and the New Testament that our behaviors are to line up with a different standard, that our behaviors, our lifestyle, our attitudes, all of those things are to be characterized by those things which God prioritizes. Well, the fact that there is, in fact, that we are in fact such flawed individuals, the fact that we are indeed characterized by sin and in some sense almost lost in our sinfulness, doesn't mean that God is limited in what he can do. And that's the point that I'm going to be hoping that we'll see in this passage, the point that I think is clear in the New Testament, and that is, yes, in fact, and indeed, left to myself, left to my own resources, I am in fact without hope with regard to behaving in any way other than in a sinful manner. An individual apart from God is lost in their sin, hopeless in their sin, but what's different about our understanding as believers is that God has taken it upon himself to work in our lives. God has taken it upon himself to change our hearts, to change our attitudes, to go to work with who we are in order to, at least in part, let me rephrase that. I was going to say in order to change our behaviors, but that's not the point. The point is not that we behave well. The point is simply that God does indeed work in our hearts, work in our lives, so that he can, through the believing community, through the faithful community, he can express something of who he is, something of what he's doing, something of his character. Well, I would agree that in the bigger picture, mankind is indeed sinful, but what we see is that God has written for believers, for those of us who are believers, for the individuals to whom Peter is writing here in 1 Peter, God has written a different story for us that involves changes in our lives, involves changes in our behavior and who we are. And throughout the New Testament, I think we see that in many places. I referred a little bit ago to Paul's comments in Hebrews 11. I think that Paul wrote Hebrews, in case there's any question about that. Paul's comments in Hebrews 11, verses 32 through 40. I'll just read a little part of this. He says, "And what more shall I say? For time will fail me if I tell of Gideon, of Barak, of Samson, of Jephthah, of David, and Samuel and the prophets, who by faith conquered mountains, performed acts of righteousness, obtained promises, shut the mouths of lions, quenched the power of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, from weakness were made strong, became mighty in war, put armies to flight. And all these, having gained approval through their faith, did not receive what was promised because God had provided something better for us." My point in reading a passage like that is simply to point out one of many places throughout the New Testament that the writers of the New Testament say God has gone about the work of changing the lives of his people, changing the lives of those that he has called, those who have responded in faith. God has set about changing their lives, changing their behaviors, so that we don't need to, in my mind, feel incapacitated by sin in our lives. Yes, we need to recognize it. I'm not suggesting we gloss it over. I'm not suggesting we go back to painting on plastic smiles or anything like that. Yes, there is the reality of sin, but there's also the reality of God's activity, of what God is doing in the lives of those who have faith. Well, I think this passage in 1 Peter actually gives us some clues to what this is all about, to how this plays out, to what this looks like. And to understand it, there's a principle that I think is true of understanding all of the scriptures, all of the Old Testament, all of the New Testament. And that is that we will have, in the same passage, we'll have this juxtaposition of two different perspectives. We will have in the same passage an expression of how things look from our perspective, from the reality in which we live, the days, the time, the geographical location. There will be things that are expressed in terms of strictly a human perspective, but there are also things that are expressed throughout the scriptures from God's perspective. And there are times that gets confusing for us because the two seem to be in opposition to each other. There are times that there will be some admonition about telling us to do something or to be someone, and then there will be, in juxtaposition that idea, a communication of the fact that it is God who is at work, that God is the one who is working and doing something. And I think the reason for that, for me, is becoming more clear as the years go by. The more I am around you folks and the more I sit around and enjoy the same sort of teaching that you folks enjoy here each Sunday, the more I'm understanding that makes sense in light of this understanding of who God is in relation to who we are. The passage, or the title of Jack's book, The Most Real Being, to me, really helps to paint that picture, helps me to understand that perspective as I understand more of what he means by that, and that is that God is so, he is in some sense more real, that what transcendence is all about is talking about and seeing and understanding that God is outside of the reality that we inhabit every day. And that's where it gets a little bit confusing for people, because sometimes we think that God is just a part of the same reality that we are, whereas what I think is the perspective of the New Testament, what we'll see in this passage and elsewhere in the scriptures, is that there are these two different planes of reality, if you will, and I'm sure I'm not doing justice to the way Jack expresses it, but these two different planes here. One is the plane that we inhabit every day, and the other is the plane that God inhabits. And what a passage like this talks about is it tells us, okay, Peter says to the hearers or to the people who received this letter, he tells them, I want you to behave in certain ways. But then he also expresses to them, because you know what? God has caused you to be born again. Or because you know what? God is building you up into this household. He uses some of these images that we're going to look at here. But that's, I think, a critical thing to understand as we look at the New Testament, is that we see things sometimes expressed simply from our perspective, sometimes from God's perspective. Let me just give you a couple of examples here. In chapter 1, verses 22 through 25, we'll look specifically at 22 and 23. And let me just warn you in advance, I'm not intending to this morning give an exhaustive treatment to everything that we have in this passage. There are some highlights that I want to talk about and that I want to focus on, but I'm not intending to deal with every issue in this passage. But here in chapter 1, verses 22 and 23, he starts off in verse 22, Peter does, by telling us about things that we're to do, attitudes that we're to have, behaviors that that we're to exhibit. He says, since you have, in obedience to the truth, purified your souls for a sincere love of the brethren, fervently love one another from the heart. Now, if there's anything that is difficult to do, virtually impossible to do, any of us who are really understanding of our own nature, of our own character, we recognize that that sort of sincere love for another person is virtually impossible for us to do. And yet this is what Peter tells them they're supposed to do. Having purified, or in obedience to the truth, having purified your souls for sincere love of the brethren, fervently love one another from the heart. Well, I read that, and I have the inclination, in recognizing my own sinfulness, in recognizing my own weakness, there's the inclination to say, you know what? It's just not going to happen. That's a hopeless endeavor. I don't have the capability. I don't have the will. That's not going to happen. But then what Peter goes on to do here in verse 23, and we're going to look quickly at verse 23 and then go back to chapter 1. Peter makes the observation. He says, you have in obedience purified your souls, fervently love one another. He says, for you have been born again, and I'm not going to go into the rest of that verse there. For you have been born again. If we go back to chapter 1, verse 3, what we're told over there is that it is God who, according to his great mercy, has caused us to be born again. The connection I want to make there is simple, straightforward, and that is, it is the fact that God has been active in our lives, having caused us to be born again. It is that which allows us in some small way to begin to sincerely and fervently love other people. Moving on to the next section here in chapter 2, verses 1 through 3. Again, what Peter does here is he lays down an imperative for us that we can't do. We cannot live the way, behave the way Peter talks about having us live. He says in 2, verse 1, he says, therefore, putting aside all malice and all guile and hypocrisy and envy and all slander, like newborn babes, long for the pure milk of the word, that by it you may grow in respect to salvation. One of the things I always love about the New Testament writers is when you read through what they have to say, whether it's Peter, John, Paul, doesn't matter who, when you read through the New Testament writers, they really understand my life, they understand my sinful impulses, and they're able to put their finger right on it. That's what Peter does here in this passage, telling us to put aside all malice, all guile, all hypocrisy, all envy, all slander. He gets right to the very core of human nature, to the very heart of the things that motivate us, the things that cause us to do some of the things that we do, the things that cause us to say some of the things that that we say. Peter gets right to those things, and he says, put those things aside. Well, again, reading that with one perspective of my nature, my sinful human nature, my inclination would be to say, you know, that's hopeless. But what Peter goes on to say here in verse 3, he says, putting aside all these things and doing these things, if you have tasted the kindness of the Lord. I think what Peter's recognizing there, it is only those who have been touched by the grace and the mercy of God who are able in any way to see those things realized in their lives. And again, let me emphasize, lest there be any misunderstanding here, I am not talking about somehow or other finding within myself some inner strength. I'm not talking about finding some kernel of good character within myself that I water and that I cause to grow up and blossom or anything like that. I'm not talking about anything that comes from me. I think the witness of the New Testament, this passage and many other passages, is that it is God's activity in our hearts, God's activity in our lives, that allows for those changed behaviors. Can I put aside all malice, all guile, all hypocrisy, envy, and slander? Well, ask my wife. No, obviously for any one of us, a charge like that is impossible. We can't live up to a standard like that. But that doesn't mean that God's activity in our lives, in showing mercy upon us, in imparting grace to us, in working in our lives, that doesn't mean that God can't take those steps in our lives. Well, then in the next section here in 1 Peter, he goes on and he paints this interesting picture about believers as living stones being built up into a spiritual house. Let me just read through that passage that we're looking at, in starting in verse 4 of chapter 2. Peter says, "And coming to him," that is God, "coming to him as a living stone rejected by men, but choice and precious in the sight of God, you also, as living stones, are being built up in a spiritual house for a holy priesthood, to offer up spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God through Jesus Christ." Well, he's going to get into a couple of quotes here from the Old Testament, but just let me tell you what I think Peter's doing here. Peter, in the next several verses, is pulling together several different Old Testament references to paint a picture, to draw out of those Old Testament references a picture of what God is doing in the community of believers even now. I think it's a picture likewise of it's hard to use the right words to express what I am about to say. I was going to say that I think it's also a picture of what God intended to do in the Old Testament, but I don't want to have that misunderstood. I don't want to suggest to you that God intended that the nation of Israel be a certain thing and that somehow or other God's intentions were foiled, or that somehow or other God failed to accomplish something that he accomplished. That's not what I believe at all. I do think, as I said earlier, that what he was doing with the nation of Israel was using them as a symbol and as a picture, while at the same time, in the Old Testament and in the New Testament, at the same time, there is the reality of that going on in the lives of those who have faith. In the lives of those who have faith, there is this reality of changed lives, different behaviors, because of God's activity. Well, in this passage, he's talking about this to this group of churches that are in Asia Minor, and he pulls together these different references that start with references to Jesus being the cornerstone of this house. And if you look at, there are a couple of places in the Old Testament that talk about a cornerstone, that talk about a choice stone. There is also in the gospel accounts, and this is what brings it a lot closer to what Peter has to say and a lot closer to this passage. In the gospel accounts in Matthew 21, verses 42 through 44, for example, Jesus takes that picture of the cornerstone and makes it clear that Old Testament picture applies to him. He actually quotes from the Old Testament. Matthew 21, it says, Jesus said to them, "Did you never read in the scriptures the stone which the builders rejected? This became the chief cornerstone. This came about from the Lord, and it is marvelous in our eyes." Mark 12, Luke 20 give the same account when Jesus, in his final week, after the triumphal entry into Jerusalem, before his crucifixion, in his final week, Jesus was overt about talking about himself as that cornerstone and talking about the fact that there are those who reject that cornerstone and those who stumble over that cornerstone. Well, Peter's picking up the same image. And in fact, Peter in Acts, when he was talking to the religious leaders in Acts chapter 4, Peter likewise used that same image of Jesus being the cornerstone which was rejected by the Jews. Well, now he's taking that same image and talking about Jesus being the cornerstone of this spiritual house that is to be built up, and we're to be stones also in that spiritual house. And I think the picture he's using there is the point that he's making is simply that even as Jesus was rejected, so also we, in who we are, in our behaviors, in our priorities, in our attitudes, to the degree that we are identified with Jesus, likewise we will be rejected as well. It's sort of a side point, but I think it is a point that Peter wants to make, that we simply are not to be conformed to this world. We are not to fit in with this world. Who we are is to be different from the world around us. Well, back to 1 Peter, there are these three separate Old Testament references that Peter makes here in verses 6, 7, and 8. He says, "This is contained in Scripture. Behold, I lay in Zion a choice stone, a precious cornerstone, and he who believes in him shall not be disappointed." This precious value, then, is for you who believe, but for those who disbelieve, the stone which the builders rejected, this became the very cornerstone, and it is a stone of stumbling and a rock of offense. Well, to do this, Peter drew together three different references out of the Old Testament, which it's always worthwhile to take a look at each of these references in their context, which we won't take the time to do today, but Isaiah 28, verse 16, this is the passage that talks about, it says, "Behold, I am laying in Zion a stone, a tested stone, a costly cornerstone, for the foundation firmly placed. He who believes in it will not be disturbed." Psalm 118, verse 22 is where Jesus got the words, "The stone which the builders rejected has become the chief cornerstone. This is the Lord's doing. It is marvelous in our eyes." And then in Isaiah 8, verse 14, Isaiah the prophet, in talking about the Lord of hosts and about his activity, it says, "Then he shall become a sanctuary both to the houses of Israel, a stone to strike and a rock to stumble over, and a snare and a trap for the inhabitants of Jerusalem." So you have these passages in the Old Testament that talk about this stone that's a cornerstone that is rejected by some, but those who depend on it won't be disturbed, and this stone that is a snare and a trap for the inhabitants of Jerusalem. You see that talked about in different places in the Old Testament, and Peter draws these together in this passage to talk about Jesus being the cornerstone. Then he goes on the end of verse 8, talking about those who have rejected this cornerstone. He says, "For they stumble because they are disobedient to this word, and to this doom they were also appointed." But in contrast, so there what he's saying, he's using that Old Testament imagery to talk about those who have turned away from, rejected the cornerstone. But then he comes back and he talks about the believing community and things that are characteristic of the believing community. And again, what's striking to me is Peter's use of the Old Testament references. An inference that I make from that is that Peter sees a continuity between the Old Testament and the New Testament in God's dealing with humanity. He sees a continuity there that it isn't as though God had one plan in the Old Testament with the nation of Israel, and when that failed, he had to go to plan B. Rather, I would suggest that there was a continuity of the plan throughout the Old Testament and the New Testament, and Peter's references here to the Old Testament help to point that out. In verse 9, again, the phrases here, he's thrown together phrases from a number of different places. He says, but you are a chosen race. Now he's talking to the believers in the churches in Asia Minor that he tells us he's addressing in chapter 1, verse 1. And he says of them, and I would suggest by extension, he says of us, but you are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for God's own possession, that you may proclaim the excellencies of him who has called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. For once, and now he switches from one set of references to a couple of references out of Hosea, he says in verse 10, for you once were not a people, but now you are the people of God. You had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy. So what Paul does, and let me just tell you where these references are found. The reference to being a chosen race is out of Isaiah. The reference to a royal priesthood, likewise out of Isaiah. The references to being a holy nation and a people for God's own possession, those were the ones that caught my attention most because they're out of Exodus 19, verses 5 and 6. And if you remember, Exodus 19 is the passage that describes God's conversation with Moses just prior to giving him the Ten Commandments. If there was anything that symbolizes, if you will, the beginning, the true beginning of the nation of Israel as a people, it was when God gave the nation of Israel the Ten Commandments and the rest of the law. We sometimes think it was just the Ten Commandments, but if you read that passage in Exodus, God goes on and on and on for several chapters about other laws that he's giving to them as well. It is the giving of the law in many respects that is what constitutes them as a separate nation, as a separate people. And the passage that Peter uses here to describe what's true of the believing community that was contemporary to him in his day, those same words are the words that God used to describe his intention for the nation of Israel. My point simply being that again, I think that God's intention all along has been that his making a people his own was to be characterized not by their racial identity, not by their ethnicity. Rather, God's choosing of them was to be characterized by their faithful response to them, or to him rather, from the very beginning on through the present day. So we have this picture over the last several verses of Peter talking about using Old Testament imagery, pulling together all of these different Old Testament references to talk about God's relationship to those people who are his own people, those people that he has made his own. And then he wraps up that discussion here in this passage. He wraps it up once again with commands to them, observations to them about how they are to behave, about how their life is to be different from the community around them. And again, he uses some of the same pictures he's used before. In chapter 2, verse 11, he says, "Beloved, I urge you as aliens and strangers," and really is something that characterizes God's people, God's people, those that he has called to himself, those who respond to him by faith, really are aliens and strangers in the world. To bring it into this day and age, the priorities, the beliefs, the attitudes, the actions of the believing community really do not fit in well with the world around us. In the world around us, it's an odd thing to think about faithfulness in marriage. It's an odd thing to think about sexual morality in biblical terms. We as believers in this day and age likewise are aliens and strangers, even as are the people to whom Peter's writing here. "I urge you as aliens and strangers to abstain from fleshly lusts which wage war against the soul. Keep your behavior excellent among the Gentiles," he says, "so that in the thing in which they slander you as evildoers, they may, on account of your good deeds as they observe them, glorify God in the day of visitation." A point that I would make is that good behavior on our part is not something that needs to happen for us to merit God's attention. It isn't something that needs to happen in order for us to be saved. That's not when we talk about the sort of behavior that Peter's talking about here, the sort of excellent behavior he's talking about. It isn't because somehow or other we need to find that in ourselves to behave in those ways in order to catch God's attention and make him do right by us. That's not the point at all. Rather, I think that excellent behavior in the community of faith today, as was the case in Peter's day as well, excellent behavior is simply to showcase and to point out what God does in the life of believers so that people will look at believers and recognize that God is at work. So people will look at how they think, how they do things, and recognize that that there's someone, that being God, someone who's behind that. Again, we don't find that in ourselves, and we don't somehow or other have to do those things in order to gain merit in God's eyes. Rather, it's something that God does in our lives so that people will see in that activity, see that that God is busy, that God is active. Well, let me just wrap up here. I really didn't intend to get into the nitty-gritty, if you will, of the things that Peter talked about in terms of behaviors when he talks about a fervent love for one another, when he talks about putting aside all malice, all guile, hypocrisy, when he talks about keeping your behavior excellent among the Gentiles. It wasn't my intention to get into any sort of nitty-gritty to say to you, this is what that looks like. That isn't what the New Testament, I think, is meant to do. It isn't meant to give sort of a one-size-fits-all response to how we're supposed to behave. The New Testament doesn't, I think, address what we're supposed to eat, what we're supposed to drink. It doesn't address what day of the week we're supposed to meet together. It isn't meant to address what we do when we assemble together as believers. The New Testament isn't meant to address whether or not we're allowed to drink, dance, chew, or go with girls who do. It isn't meant to address those things at all. That isn't the intention of the New Testament. It's intended to address our heart attitude. It's intended to address what's going on inside as God works in our lives, because that is indeed what God is interested in. Yes, our behaviors, I believe, will change, but our behaviors will change from the inside out rather than the other way around. It isn't that we change what we do and we make things look good on the outside, and somehow or other that makes us good people. Rather, it is that God goes to work in our lives. God goes to work in our hearts, changing them, drawing us closer to himself, and our lives and our behaviors change as a result. And I think that's part of what Peter's trying to communicate here in this passage is, yes, from our perspective, we're to do certain things. We're to have certain attitudes, and we're to have certain behaviors characterize or not characterize our lives. But the reality is that behind the scenes, God's the one who is willing and working for his good pleasure. Well, that's all I have to say about the passage this morning. I have left time for questions or for us to get out early and enjoy the sunshine, depending on how many questions there are. So if anybody has any questions, I'd be happy to try and address some.
In verse 10, when it says, in the past, not a people, but now are now the people of God, I'm a little confused by that. Can you kind of elaborate on that? Does that mean that we were out without kind of affiliation or brotherhood or sisterhood or hope or something, and now we have that?
Yeah, I'll try to elaborate a little bit. These quotes specifically are out of Hosea. Hosea is just a fascinating, interesting book because Hosea, as you may know, is the account of the prophet that God tells to marry a prostitute. He marries her. She wanders off again and again. He keeps welcoming her back. That seems to be a picture of God's relationship with the nation of Israel. The nation of Israel kept wandering off and following other gods, and God kept calling them back. So in this case, the first phrase here, actually, you once were not a people, now you are the people of God, that actually was to be reflected in the name of one of Hosea's children. But I think the point of, again, here I believe we're talking about understanding this passage both in the context that it was given to Hosea, but also understanding this passage in light of what God was saying and doing throughout the Old and New Testament. What God was saying in Hosea is he's saying that he's ready to keep welcoming back the children of Israel. Once we're not a people, but now you are the people of God. I think that is, in the context of Hosea, I think that's a reference to the fact that they had wandered off, had distanced themselves from God, and he was offering the opportunity to welcome them back to become his people. But in this context, here in 1 Peter, I think that it has the additional import of speaking to the Gentiles who, in every respect, from a Jewish perspective, were not the people of God. For the Gentiles, the Jews understood that they were, in fact, God's chosen people. The Gentiles were not. And Peter's observation here, I think, is simply saying to those Gentile believers, once you were not a part of the people of God, but now you are a people of, now you are a part of the people of God. Once you had not received mercy, now you have. The earlier verse, you're now a people, a holy nation, a people for God's own possession. And again, what I'm going to suggest is that God's meaning, his intention all along from the garden on, was that those people who responded to him by faith were the people that are to be identified as his people from the very beginning. And for each of us, or for each of the hearers of Peter's letter here, for them in their own experience, their recognition would be, a week ago, I didn't know who God was. I wasn't interested in pursuing God. I wasn't interested in anything that he had to do with. Now I am interested. So in that experience, once you were not a people, now you are a part of the people of God. Once you had not received mercy, now you have received mercy. That speaks to our own experience. That doesn't speak to what was going on from God's perspective in his transcendence, but it does speak to our own experience and that of the people to whom Peter was writing here.
So would you say this is kind of a continuation or expansion of what God revealed to him with the unclean animals and so on?
Yeah, it's all part of one picture with Peter. You're talking about when he was going to see Cornelius in Acts, and he has this vision of the sheep being lowered with the unclean animals, and Peter says, I can't do that. That's off limits to me. And God tells him that what God has cleaned, he shouldn't consider unclean. So, yeah, that was part of, I think, the cultural transformation, if you will, that Peter had to go through in reorienting his thinking to understand it isn't just about the Jews. It isn't just about the nation of Israel. In fact, God's plan and his purposes go way beyond just the nation of Israel. And the walls have been broken down between Jew and Gentile. I mean, there are all these New Testament pictures that go along with it. But, yeah, certainly Peter's experiences in Acts, when he was sent to a Gentile and told to sit down and eat what he considered to be unclean, he was told basically to sin from his perspective. I mean, he would have thought of that as sin. He was told to sin because what God was saying is, no, you've misunderstood it. You've got your priorities in the wrong place. And in fact, what I want you to understand, Peter, is that Gentiles are welcomed in as well.
I think it's safe to say that most of us have not been barbarian pirates or, meth making bikers.
Most of us.
Yes. Yeah. Or, stage entertainers. It seems that a lot of what the Spirit does in us, given that we've been raised in a very Christianized culture and a very civilized society, the change between before you were a believer and after you're a believer can almost go unnoticeable. I mean, it can be really subtle. Mm-hmm. You can be, quote-unquote, a pillar of society, captain of industry, exemplary citizen, and be hellbound in our culture. Mm-hmm. And so when you're talking to someone about this marks you as a believer, once you get past the externals, the observable behaviors, it becomes really subtle and very subjective and a real deep personal struggle. And so when we tell people, wrestle with your sinfulness, beware of your sinfulness, but cheer up, you're going to see big changes. I mean, you're going to be able to see God working in you. Where? I mean, Jack is fond of saying, does it really take the power of God for you not to play cards, not to drink, not to dance, not to vote Democrat? Where when you encourage someone, you will see God working and people will notice it. And they say, I'm desperate. Give them three quick responses that say, oh, you'll see it here and it'll be obvious. What would you say?
I wouldn't. But let me respond to what you're saying, and let me get myself sidetracked here for a little bit. In studying church history, and I think you would share this perspective. In studying church history, I think perhaps the worst thing that happened to the church in the 4th century was when Christianity was legalized by Constantine. Because at that point, Christianity went from being a persecuted religion where there was a cost to belief. You had to really want to believe in order to follow, it was much easier to follow a course that that didn't involve belief. And when Christianity then was legalized, everything else got mixed in with it. Just like in our culture today, in America in 2008, everything else is mixed in with it. So yes, I'll betray my bias here. I'm really getting tired of the candidates talking about religion. And it is so easy for to have the pundits talk about religion. There's one guy I watch from time to time, and every time somebody comes on his show who talks about being a Christian, he'll say, "Yeah, I'm a Christian and you're a Christian." And, well, we don't know if they're all believers or not, but it has gotten so easy, like you're saying, in our society, in our culture, to seem like it. So in response to your question, yeah, the externals might not change at all. The externals are not the key issue. It is all about what's going on in the inner man. It's all about getting to the real heart of who we are. And that's where I think that Peter, in some of his comments here, he nails us to the wall. Because if I am honest with myself, we'll use slander. If I'm honest with myself, I may not be guilty of slander in that I haven't published some of my thoughts about someone else. I haven't spoken them out loud. I haven't put them in print. But slander, am I capable of it? You better believe it. So what Peter is talking about, what the other New Testament writers talk about, is that change that chances are real good. I'm not going to see it in somebody else. You're not going to see it in somebody else. But we're going to recognize it in ourselves. We're going to recognize, I think part of that change even, I'm going to suggest, part of that change that God brings about is an increasing awareness of our own sin. So, in fact, it is that sense that we have of how sinful we are and how deep and profound that is that is indicative of the fact that God's working in our lives, that God is, in fact, changing our hearts and changing our attitudes. Because before, we didn't think twice about it. We really didn't think much about our own sinfulness. But as God's at work in our lives, we see things pointed out more and more. We're more aware of our own sinfulness. So I don't know if that answers your question, but, yeah, we're not gonna see it. I couldn't give you one, two, three things. I guess if I were to give you one thing, one change that you could expect when you become a believer, it would probably be an increasing awareness of your own sinfulness. Yes?
I'm an amateur baker. I make cheese. I make pickles. And so I'm kind of an amateur on culture. And one thing that occurred to me was Jesus said about the Pharisees, he said, do what they say, don't do as they do. They sit in Moses' seat. Therefore, do what they say. In other words, he didn't say the things they're saying about God, the things they're saying about the law and their reverence for the scriptures was wrong. He says, yeah, do what they say, but don't do as they do. And that when he says, beware of the leaven of the Pharisees, he's talking about the culture of the Pharisees, not so much their professions of what's right and wrong and what's true, as in how you live this out. This seems to me to be the big difference. And I started thinking about this nature of doctrine, and there seems to be an emphasis on doctrine as propositional truths that we can get right, you know. But it seems that when you're reading Peter, there seems to be another emphasis on doctrine that has to do with right living. Paul forbids these things to do that are, or anything else that's contrary to right doctrine, like adultery, theft, lying, and so on. That's also doctrine. But there's one third thing, and several times in the New Testament it says they were amazed at his doctrine, talking about Jesus healing people. It didn't say specifically any doctrine there. Or Paul talking to Sergius Paulus and striking the and pronouncing judgment against Elymas the magician. It says, and he was amazed at his doctrine. There seems to be a necessity of a real supernatural element. It's not just saying the doctrine God works in our heart and lives. There has to be a manifestation of this supernatural life it seems that that's also right doctrine. We're bearing witness about the, you know, about God, about Christ, about everything he's done. And if there is no supernatural life, well, frankly, the doctrine's wrong.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree wholeheartedly. Couldn't have said it better. There's that is part of the doctrine. If it's part of the teaching, part of the teaching is exactly what you have just said, and that is, apart from the supernatural intervention by God, apart from his activity, apart from him doing what he says he's going to do in terms of showing mercy, showing grace, us being his workmanship, that sort of thing, apart from those things, yeah, nothing will change. It isn't good doctrine that changes us. It's God that changes us. Okay. Anybody else?
I had to step out briefly, so possibly you already addressed this, but the idea that change is inevitable, that I can't change myself, but God will change me if I am, in fact, a believer, that the things that Peter is asking, saying that we should do, God will allow me to do, will cause me to do, has resulted in some people talking to folks who are struggling with sin and say, well, you know, yeah, you can't do it. God will do it. If God's not doing it, you must not be a believer. And I was just, what do I say to myself, and what do I say to other people when I find myself not having victory? If I recognize that I can't do it myself, that God has to do it, but God isn't doing it, isn't one possible explanation that I don't really belong to God, that I'm not really a believer? And how do I, is that a wrong way to think about it? And how do I not lose hope and despair when I find myself stuck in a sin that I wish I could shake and I can't?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the other response to the individual that you're talking about that is such a deadly response, as deadly as the response that maybe you're not a believer, the other response that is every bit as deadly is, well, if only you had more faith, then this issue would be dealt with, this sin would be dealt with, something like that. The more I read the scriptures, the more I just am amused, I don't know if that's the right, probably not the right word, but amused, amazed at the way that God works that is so different from the way I work, so different from the way I think. I would be inclined to just, if things were linear, I would be inclined to think in terms of, yes, if God says he's going to deal with sin and he doesn't, you must not be a believer, you must not have enough faith. I'd be inclined to have those same sorts of responses if I didn't see that, you know what? God does whatever the heck he wants to do, quite apart from the way I think he should be doing it. And I see that those examples of that again and again and again and again throughout the scriptures, Old Testament and New Testament. So what I then come to understand, what I have to deal with is his way of doing things doesn't fit my model. And if he sees fit with David, for example, to characterize David as a man after his own heart, and then have David commit adultery with Bathsheba, and then conspire to murder Uriah the Hittite, but still be characterized as a man after God's own heart, well, that's not the way I would have done that, or that's not the way I would have shown that to be true. But if that's the way God does that, if that's the way God chooses to deal with David, to make him the man he wants him to be and to accomplish what he wants to through David, who am I to tell God? I mean, it's the the Romans' observation, how does the potter answer back to the clay rather answer back to the potter? So I guess my only response to that, Margaret, would be that it isn't simply a matter of if this, then this, because God's the one that's at work. If I'm still struggling with sin, it's just way too simplistic to say, or when I'm still struggling with sin, way too simplistic to say, well, I must not be a believer, or to say, well, I must not have enough faith. Because the reality is that God does things his own way, in his own time, at his own pace, and the way he does things does not in any way fit with my plans. I'd have written the scenario a lot differently for myself, as well as for most other people, than God has written it.
And it seems like to somebody who's struggling with sin, the fact that one of the things that I could say to encourage that person is to say the fact that you are struggling with sin is evidence that God is at work in you, and he's doing a whole lot more than merely making me somebody who doesn't, you know, lust after my neighbor's husband or something like that. He's creating faith in me and understanding and compassion for people who are also struggling, and a recognition that I am not God, and that this is difficult stuff. And it seems like there's so much more going on.
You bet. Yeah, and I agree with that, and that's a very good way to look at it. Sometimes the only indication that we have about God's activity in our own lives or in the life of somebody else, perhaps even, is that they're worked up about it. They're agitated. They're troubled about it. They're thinking it through. It might not result in changed behavior there. I'm perfectly comfortable with God saving someone who is deeply mired in sin, and 30 years later, they are just as deeply mired in sinful behaviors, but that doesn't mean necessarily that God didn't save them. That just means that his activity, his pace, what he's doing, where he's working in their lives is perhaps different than it would be for me. I can pick out the things, well, let's deal with that issue first, and then that issue. That isn't the way God does things. But the fact that that he is at work is as I think you just said, it's often characterized just by someone's awareness, not necessarily by other changes.
And grieving.
Yeah, absolutely. Anybody else? I hear babies crying in the back room, so if there are no other questions, we're done for the day. Thank you.